president needs to utilize the Defense Production Act more effectively than he has been.
Unbelievable. The human saga of being stricken with this.
Hi, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus, and on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, we'll talk about COVID-19 with New York U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and an ICU doctor at Albany Medical Center who's been dealing with the crisis. First, my conversation with New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. I spoke with the Democrat late last week.
Well, I certainly feel enormous gratitude to our first responders and our frontline workers. I think people now see how important food workers are and people who work in grocery stores and in pharmacies, as well as our doctors and nurses. For me, it's really put a fine point on how we have to do better in making sure our frontline workers have basic safety nets. We really need universal sick days in this country, and there's no better example than what's happened right now. So I want to make sure every worker in America gets 2 weeks of sick days. I also want to focus a lot more attention on national paid leave, because if we had had that, then there would have been a vehicle for people to actually stay home with their children if schools are closed for a month or two or three, or for people to stay home if they're sick themselves or are caring for a sick loved one. And so what this epidemic and pandemic has really done for me is focus my attention on where we should be focusing our advocacy, that it is these frontline workers, the caregivers, the people who feed our children, create food for our whole economy and country, people who are doing just low wage but urgent and essential work, that they actually need to be lifted up and valued more, because they are the ones who are saving people from dying right now.
Well, those are not new issues for you. How do you get Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in your chamber to go along with them?
Well, I think using this example to explain to them that without these kinds of safety nets, we don't have the tools we need to defend against something like an epidemic or a pandemic virus like this. It also shows that their ideology in some respects doesn't reflect who the parts of the economy that really do have the greatest value. And so as opposed to just tax cuts for the wealthy, we really need these social safety nets for the people who are doing the real work that keep our communities alive and thriving.
Almost as soon as Congress passed the first $2.2 trillion package, there was talk about the need for another COVID bill, which is now being discussed. Beyond the things you've mentioned so far, what else would you like to see in another stimulus bill?
So for the next bill, we're hoping that we can fix some of the small business provisions before we add more money to it. A lot of restaurants haven't been able to use the small business provisions because they have no revenue coming in, so no ability to pay their employees or get up and running while the economy shut down. It's also highlighted that not all of the banks are servicing some of our community small businesses, so the urgency of getting more community banks, more credit unions involved, and getting them access to the SBA lending program. So those are some things we want to change. I also want to make sure we actually add paid leave for the rest of the workforce in America. The second bill only covered about 25% of workers, same with the sick days. So we want to make those two things universal if we can. We also need more money for food. People are finding when they don't have a paycheck, it's very hard to pay for food, and the food banks are overwhelmed. So getting more resources in to feed our communities will be a priority for me.
In the current bill, the CARES Act, you've raised concern that the stimulus checks, which are supposed to go out beginning Monday, $1,200 for people making under $75,000 a year, won't reach people, A, in a timely manner, and B, if they don't have a permanent address. In other words, if they've been homeless, that money won't be able to get to them. How do you ensure that people actually get these checks?
So, first of all, anyone who's ever paid their taxes online will get it directly into their bank account. People who pay their taxes through the mail will get it in the mail. But then for people who have no address, so homeless people, people living in shelters, it's going to be urgent to be able to work with social services to get money to the most at need, at risk. And I think that's going to take a real investment by the cities and states and localities to make sure those people aren't left behind.
Governor Cuomo has been saying that he is speaking to you on the phone. He's had a lot of complaints about that first bill. He says it gave New York State short shrift, which the state is dealing with its own budget shortfall. What do you say to that?
So I appreciate the very good work that the governor's doing. He's provided excellent leadership during this crisis, far better leadership than President Trump. And he has a real challenge because he cannot close his budget gap because he has no revenues coming to the state. The bill that we passed, which was actually the third bill, so we call it COVID-3, was not meant to be one that could make all budgets whole because it wasn't enough money for that. What it was intended to do was triage. We needed to get money immediately to the hospital so they didn't collapse. We needed to get money immediately to individuals so they, as families, could provide for their kids and actually have food on the table and the medicine they need. So that was urgent. Money for small businesses, and then money for states and local governments. We sent a lot of money to New York State in many forms. Through all the different forms, about $40 billion is going to the state. And so that's just a first step. It's not intended to be everything. So the next bill is going to be equally as important, getting more money to the state and localities. We'll try to do another $150 billion, which is doubling what we – last time we did $150 billion, too. So we're doubling the amount into the states. And hopefully the governor will begin to see some of the benefits of where money is going to mass transit, MTA, to Port Authority, money to all the businesses around the state, small and large, money to people, money to localities and cities, money for other supply chain issues. We put several $1 billion into the stockpile, $16 billion. So again, that'll be more resources for the governor to get more masks, more ventilators, more PPE. But again, it's not nearly enough, and we'll keep fighting for more. We appreciate all the work he's doing, but this was just our first effort to do triage.
Senator, are you worried that President Trump, because he sees what's happening to the economy and potentially, the polling on his performance, is going to move to reopen the country before it's safe to do that?
I hope he doesn't. I hope he doesn't suggest we should reopen before it is safe. I hope he listens to his medical experts. I think it's going to take us a lot longer than people want because, unfortunately, this is a rolling epidemic. And so while New York might be spiking now, some places in upstate New York won't be spiking until end of April or mid-May. And parts of the country probably won't have their most number of cases till mid-May, June, or even July. So the truth is we don't know how long it's going to take to eradicate or contain COVID-19, but we do know it's been a lot harder to contain it than I think certainly the president ever estimated. So we just have to keep working hard and try to protect our communities as best we can, try to limit the number of people who are exposed, and try to limit the number of people who are dying. And that's the best we can do for our country right now, and that's going to take a lot more medical support, a lot more resources for our first responders, more personal protective equipment, more ventilators. The president needs to utilize the Defense Production Act more effectively than he has been, which is getting our manufacturers to create a supply chain of what we need. We also need our drug makers to finish their testing on the vaccine as well as finish their testing on therapeutics. We need the regulators to do expedited review so that we can have these vaccines available by the end of the year, not 18 months from now, but by the end of the year. And frankly, we need the manufacturers of the rapid tests to manufacture more quickly and find other manufacturers to assist because we need testing. I really think we should be able to test every school child before they go back to school, before we expose classmates and teachers in our communities to perhaps people who have it, who are asymptomatic. We need universal testing, and we're a long way from that. So I think we just have to keep investing in the resources and first responders and healthcare providers as well as the drug companies that are creating the therapeutics, vaccines, and testing kits.
Why was the U.S. so unprepared for this?
You know, I think there'll be a lot of investigation of that over the weeks and months to come. I think we don't know right now why our supply chain wasn't quickly utilized to get PPE. Some of the decisions the Trump administration made were mistakes. They did not take this epidemic seriously until it was very much too late. They should have been stockpiling and getting manufacturing up and running in January. They waited till March. If I was president, I would have used the Defense Production Act starting in January and really built up our critical supplies and get them distributed all across the country. We waited too long to have stay-home orders, and I think that's a mistake. So the president, you know, this is the first pandemic we've had, certainly in my lifetime, and there'll be lots of time to Monday morning quarterback it. But those are the few things that I think are pretty obvious that we should have done differently.
I want to change gears and ask you about the statement you recently put out about the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which decided not to enact enhanced safety regulations for stretch limousines. Those changes were recommended by the NTSB, and that followed the 2018 crash in Schoharie that killed 20 people, we all remember. What's behind that decision? And obviously you would like them to change course. How do you get that to happen?
Well, NHTSA, which is the oversight organization, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, declined to put forward the regulations that were recommended by the NTSB, which is the National Transportation Safety Board. They made two really common sense recommendations to require lap shoulder belts for each passenger seating and for all new vehicles to be modified to be used as limousines to require that lap shoulder belt. They recommended that they require seating systems and stretch limousines to meet minimum performance standards to ensure their integrity during a crash. Those two recommendations, unfortunately, were ignored by NHTSA, and basically the Trump administration decided not to protect public safety. The fact that they're unwilling to put these common sense regulations in place means that the legislation that I've been working on with Senator Schumer and some of our Capital Region delegation should be actually voted on. We have three or four common sense bills that could fix this problem. So we want to get this legislation included in the next Surface Transportation Reauthorization Bill, which hopefully we will get to negotiate this year, but we don't know if that'll happen. The bottom line is it's a failure to protect safety. It's an outrage given how many people have died because of the lack of safety standards. And I'm deeply concerned that President Trump's administration just wants to deregulate at all costs, even if the cost is the lives of our loved ones.
Have you been in touch at all with the families of the Schoharie victims about this?
Not this most recent insult, but I will reach out.
U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat from New York. Thank you so much, Senator, for taking this time for us at this time. We appreciate it.
Well, God bless to all your listeners, and I hope everyone stays home and stays safe. And every time we block a transmission of this virus, we are doing good for others and saving lives. So I hope everyone realizes that they have a big role to play themselves.
Now let's listen to my interview with Dr. Andy Coates, Assistant Professor of Medicine and Psychiatry at Albany Medical College. The internist has been working on the COVID-19 critical care team at Albany Medical Center's intensive care unit. You might recognize Dr. Coates from his past WAMC commentaries and his role with Physicians for a National Health Program. And Dr. Coates, to begin with, tell us what it's been like at this time for you and your work.
Well, in the hospital for four weeks, there has been an eerie calm with the command for social distancing, the fact that the St. Patrick's Day week, the medical students were abruptly sent home and away from the patients, that all kinds of elective surgeries were one by one canceled until they were entirely canceled. The census of the hospital went down. Visitors are banned. And so the pace of the hospital slowed at the same time that patients with COVID-19 related illness, especially COVID-19 pneumonia, began to fill up the wards. And that's been happening slowly here in Albany, but boy, has it been happening. The eerie calm, I have to say that in my entire life, I've never had a feeling like that, where you're reading the medical science, you're reading about the virus, about what it's done to human beings in Wuhan, China, or Milan, Italy. You're hearing, because the world is a small world, you're hearing from friends or friends of friends who are physicians in, say, New Orleans or Elmhurst, or, in fact, directly Milan at one point. You're hearing what they're saying in the patients, and you know it's coming, but it isn't here yet. So that eeriness is now settled because, oh boy, here it is.
What are you seeing in the patients?
So the patients that are admitted to the hospital, fortunately, many patients are admitted to the hospital with real symptoms and real problems that demand intensive monitoring, but that doesn't mean intensive care. And thankfully, I think a majority of those patients are able to go home. There is a subset of patients, however, who follow a kind of a pattern where they're needing some oxygen, then they're needing more oxygen, and then very, very abruptly, they're needing way too much oxygen, and they're about to die, and they need to be put on a ventilator. And it's that tipping point that is extremely stressful for their nurses and for all of us, leads to thinking about how do we best monitor these patients, knowing that that's what can happen. And then when it does happen, the worst case scenario is a diagnosis of an ARDS-like picture. In other words, both lungs are completely full of way too much inflammation. And without a ventilator, the patient will not live.
Do you know why some patients make that turn and some don't?
We don't. The fact is we don't. We know from very good observational studies that have been done in a great hurry in other countries that age and some comorbidities, diabetes, hypertension, I think, leading diabetes, coronary artery disease, those comorbidities seem to carry an unfavorable prognosis. But that's different from saying, do we understand exactly why the virus attacks this or that person? I think the bigger picture is harder to get our brains around. The bigger picture is not so much why this would happen to, say, Ian or Andy. The bigger picture is we don't have herd immunity as a species. So as, we're mammals living on planet Earth. This is a virus that infected many other species in China, or perhaps here in the United States or in any country where there are factories in the fields, way too many animals pushed together. And the virus mutated through evolution because it was evolutionary pressure based upon the economic system was placed upon the virus to mutate. And it mutated very cleverly, probably from pigs to humans, but perhaps from another species to humans, perhaps from birds, probably went through about half a dozen or more species, and mutated to a place where our immune system, as the species that it is now infecting, our immune system does not recognize it. And frankly, our immune system has the capacity to utterly freak out once infected. Once the virus is inside our cells replicating, our bodies recognize it as a foreign enemy, but don't recognize it as a foreign enemy that they've ever, that the immune system has ever seen before. And so the immune system basically fires its entire arsenal all at once. And that inflammatory cascade leads to overwhelming organ damage. It can be the lungs, but we're also learning it can be the heart, and it can be the kidneys, it can be the clotting system. The bigger picture of the lack of herd immunity, I think, is hard for us to get, because in our time, we live in a culture that's not very science-based. We live in a culture that's got a lot of magical thinking.
What could we have done? What are we doing wrong? Let's say that American society, the way it's structured now, is a given. People are, there's a political divide and people travel a lot. Those two things were a fact when this disease started spreading in Asia. So what should we have done?
Well, I think the idea that the mutation of a virus to become deadly and become pandemic is not a new idea. The idea of an avian bird flu, the fear that Ebola could become an international disease, SARS-1, which, by the way, this is SARS-2, right? SARS-1 was a coronavirus, a novel coronavirus that was novel to the immune system and therefore was deadly, and was an epidemic that killed people in many countries. We had the pandemic of influenza in 1918, the famous Spanish influenza that I believe started in Kansas, misnomer, Spanish influenza. So I think the idea of a pandemic in terms of the fact that it exists in the world or could exist shouldn't have been ignored. It's shocking to think that it was shrugged off. And then it was basically appalling as we are learning the news that in early January, the alarm bells were appropriately sounded. And if the appropriate measures had been taken in the United States, thousands upon thousands of lives could have been saved. And I'm saying that based upon comparison to other nations. If you look at Singapore, if you look at South Korea, you look at Hong Kong, you look at certain countries that had SARS-1 and took it seriously, they're able to bend the curve from the beginning and prevent what's happened in New York and Milan and New Orleans. There was a string of text messages that I saw from South Korea that really made me think. They texted the community along the lines of this. If you were at a middle school, say one of our own community's middle schools, Farnsworth, if you were, and you were worried about the student who everyone thought had coronavirus, we want you to know that that student has tested negative and you can rest easy. Please wash your hands. Next text message. If you went to the grocery on this date, there's a chance you have been exposed. Would you please come in voluntarily and get tested so that we can find out whether or not you're infected? Next, please wash your hands. Next text message. So public health using social media in real time to get the populace moving. And because of that, you would think that would raise enormous consciousness about how the virus is spread, social distance, just what does it mean? And I found myself a little bit astonished with friends, that I'm catching up with in the community in the evening, for example. And they're asking me, well, how is it spread? And I'm finding myself saying a basic public health lesson, it's a tiny virus. It's less than half a micrometer. That means that tens of thousands of, if you line them up in a line, you get tens of thousands of virions, before you got to an inch. That's how small they are. And they're mostly spread by droplet. So that means that if as I'm talking to you now, every T and P and, there's probably a microscopic droplet coming out onto my telephone here. And I think coronavirus lives on plastic for several days. Those droplets, if you touch one of those droplets and it's still viable, and then you touch your eye or your nose or your mouth, it gets into your mucosa, then that little tiny piece of RNA can take over the machinery of your cell. In a brilliant way, it takes over the internal cellular machinery, and it uses your own RNA to pump millions and millions of copies of itself back out, so that your droplets, you got it from somebody else's droplet. This is what it means to have droplet precautions and wash your hands, and for God's sakes, don't touch your face, and probably why Atul Gawande is right, that if you wear a mask, at least you're not touching your face. So this is droplets. Then could it aerosolize? Well, evidently it does aerosolize. The good news is that it drops to the ground pretty quickly, so the 6-foot distancing is safe if it drops to the ground within 3 feet. The bad news is it could really aerosolize if a patient were very sick and coughing or needing a ventilator, then that's when my nurse colleagues are really at risk.
Yeah, so how are you keeping yourself safe in the hospital? Do you have enough PPE, a phrase that we've all learned this week?
So our planning for PPE has been a touchy subject because the United States of America did not plan to have enough PPE. So I think I dare say there is nowhere, no healthcare facility in the country that is bragging that it has too much PPE. And it gets a little bit tricky because the leaders of the institutions have to plan for the surge. So the plan would be to go to 150% of capacity. We have, you know, ordinarily the way the hospital works is you have enough PPE for the week and you know the average use for the week, and then you keep the supplies coming, and to keep the overhead low, you get just-in-time deliveries, and everything kind of rolls along. Incidentally, that's exactly the way the toilet paper works, right? The toilet paper in the supermarket. There's not a toilet paper warehouse behind the supermarket. There's a truck that comes just in time to replenish the shelf, and so if there's a small increase in demand for toilet paper, the shelf is empty. Similarly with the PPE in the hospital. So what the leaders of our hospital have done is come up with a very clever way to extend the life of what are meant to be single-use masks, the N95 masks, with UV sterilization and another form of sterilization to follow. But the reason they're doing that is because whatever stockpile they're keeping is meant to meet that potential 150% of capacity surge. The other problem with PPE, of course, is that we use a lot more of it. I don't know the factor. I don't know these inventory numbers, but we use a lot more when the patient is ill. And absolutely, we use appropriate PPE to protect ourselves and to make sure that our nurse colleagues are protected. And so I think difficult question from the sense that you wouldn't want healthcare workers to feel that their leadership or the society didn't care about them. The bottom line is the whole country was not prepared from the point of view of PPE, and still still the federal policy is to make the states fight with each other.
Let me ask you a question that Governor Cuomo has rejected in his recent comments. He says it's kind of an impossible one to answer. But from your perspective, inside Albany Med and working on people every day, how does this all end?
So we don't know. I think the answer is we don't know. And I think I think that might be what Governor Cuomo told Professor Chartok today, that, you know, we don't know. I think there are some very, very alarming data from the Imperial College of London that suggests that if the social distancing is lifted, if the travel bans are lifted, that the ICUs will fill up again, and then the social distancing will need to be reimposed. Then the ICUs will empty out, and social distancing will be released, and then the ICUs will fill up again. So you see a sawtooth curve of filling up the ICUs, social distancing, emptying the ICUs, relaxing social distancing, and it goes on for over a year. It's a very distressing graph to look at. And this graph is distressing because of the understanding of the lack of herd immunity that I was talking about before, because we don't have what it takes in our immune systems to treat this like a usual coronavirus, a common cold. It's a novel coronavirus that can kill you. So, so I don't know how it ends, except with antibody testing to know that you're immune, and then very, very good science that follows the virus to know that it has not evolved into yet another deadly virus to which you're not immune, which is, I think, theoretically out there. Or, you know, because it could also mutate into something that's a lot less deadly. We could hope for that. And we could even hope that that's already happening. So I think a vaccine, but realistically, with Dr. Fauci, a vaccine is, you know, we're talking, what, Halloween 2021, Thanksgiving 2021. And then it has to be produced in mass quantities. So so how does it end? It doesn't end quickly. It ends over months to years.
You started med school in the mid-90s. Is this unique in your years of experience, the situation?
It's unique in everyone's experience. This is, you know, this is a world-changing event. I think I saw the statistic of jobless claims, 16 million in recent weeks. The economy can't go. If people can't go to work, the economy can't go at all. The most astonishing thing to me about this pandemic and the social crisis that we're sliding into is in many ways the mask has come off the way our society works. African Americans disproportionately killed by this virus, and the reason is they've been dispossessed, you know, homeless shelters, inner cities, the incredible poverty, jails. I understand that Rikers Island is per capita the highest density of coronavirus on the planet. Appalling racism that is official as well. You know, think about the Trump family and how they had racist housing policies in their projects when back in the day, how Trump's father was supposed to be sympathetic with the Ku Klux Klan and even protested with the Ku Klux Klan. Once upon a time, Trump's own unbelievable comments, calling it a Chinese virus, which is an outrage. The mask is off, you know. What it means to be poor. Chris Churchill in the Times Union, our own Times Union today, a beautiful column about the observation that it's a dividing line. If you have to use a laundromat, if you're a person that needs to use a laundromat, then you're much more susceptible to dying of the coronavirus because you're much more susceptible to getting it. And the poor neighborhoods of Queens, which are being decimated, you know, you have to use the subway. You have to. And if you don't go to work, you don't eat. So I think, you know, the mask off the society and the cruelty, the injustice, the inequities, we feel that pretty, pretty poignantly. So there's been nothing like that in my life for sure. And I have to say, dealing with it personally, you know, we have patients from Queens here in Albany. It's so hard to call their family. It's unbelievable, the human saga of being stricken with this, put on a ventilator, flown by helicopter to Albany because the hospital down there is overwhelmed. And then think about that, you know? I mean, it's just very, very revealing of the planet we live on and also the American society that we currently have.
Well, Dr. Andy Coates, thank you so much for taking time right now when it is a difficult time to take a half hour. I appreciate it. And, you know, thanks for doing the work you're doing.
You too.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thank you for listening. Remember to stay safe. We'll see you next time. I'm Ian Pickus.